Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Richest Men in Town podcast. I'm Mike Freeman, and along with my good friend and co-host Tyler Gould, we're excited to welcome you to our little podcast project. Tyler and I are just a couple of middle-aged husbands and dads driven to live our best lives. We want to be better every day, so here we'll be sitting down with great people. Not famous people, but great people that we admire, to learn their secret to living the rich life. Probably not the rich life you're thinking of. Our guests come in humbled and surprised at the invitation and hopefully leave feeling proud and grateful, realizing just how good they really have it. So pull up a chair, stay a while, and raise a glass with us as we toast our guests to the richest men in town. Here we are, Tyler Gould. October is here.
Yeah.
And it's high school reunion time for you.
Yeah. Right?
Richest men in town, just bringing people together.
Bringing them together. Like people
Sean McMasters.
Yeah. 30 years. He said 30 years. That's crazy to me. Come on now.
So we just had an opportunity to hang out a couple hours with Sean McMasters, good old high school buddy of yours. And then nothing, right? Like, it's kind of cool because it really is the reunion, because you guys are coming back and he gets to tell you the journey he's been on over the last 30 years and what a journey he has been on. What is bouncing around in your head after our time with Sean?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, it's like I knew Sean a little bit years and years and years ago and didn't know that obviously the depth of the story of Sean. And so it was eye opening. But it was also, I mean, there were some times in this podcast that Sean said some things that really, honestly, Mike, spoke peace to my soul. And I love that about this podcast. I love that about these conversations, right? We're looking at things from different angles, and yet there is common ground in there that spoke literally peace to my soul tonight.
Yeah. This is one of those like, uh-oh, Kelly Freeman, because I'm going to come out of here fired up, right? I'm going to come out of here. It's late. It's late where we're at. We're not tired yet, but it's late. And yeah, we're going to come out jazzed because exactly that. Sean McMasters, man, when you asked him what gives him hope, I felt my hope increasing.
Yeah, you and me both. Yeah.
Right? And just that idea of, yeah, resting in some of the things that we know and some of the things that we believe. And it all comes from this crazy backdrop, right? Where we don't get to choose necessarily how we come into this life and some of the circumstances that we find ourselves in early on. And Sean's a classic example of somebody who had a deck stacked against him a little bit, right? That yeah. Childhood is not normal. It's not a Rockwell painting. It's not a Hallmark movie. It's rough. And he feels like it's normal.
Yeah.
Right. But as he's going through this, embedded deep in him is this idea that God loves me.
Yeah.
I know that. And that was a cool conversation, right? Like, whoa, talk to me about that. Where does that come from? So
yeah,
all kinds of good things. Great, great takeaways. Power of doctrine, right? We talk about grace. Holding them both comes up. Brian Groh, we owe you another nickel, right? Just yeah, this idea of like, hey, I'm going to strive, but I know that in my strive, I'm not going to make it.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right. It's peanuts for diamonds. Right, but so boy, he wants those to be the best that he can give. So many good things. And man, you want to talk about a love story? You want to talk about a cool across the richest men in town chronicles? This one here, where he meets his wife Linda, that's kind of a cool take.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there's so many good takeaways, and I think there's so many things in here that, regardless of where you are in your journey in life, you know, Sean talks about fits and starts. And I think there's a lot of relatable things in there that people can say, hey, yeah, I find myself in there. And I think there's hope in the words that Sean talks about tonight.
And there's a couple of times where he makes this statement, I just didn't know how to navigate that.
Yeah.
You know, and to the gyms out there, right? Jim Wells, thank you for coming alongside Sean and helping him, right? And being that person. And again, being authentic, we can be of influence if we show up vulnerable, if we show up authentic, if we show up imperfect and quick to show how we make it right when we make mistakes. Just maybe there's a Sean McMasters watching us. And just maybe we'll get asked a question in our daily walk, and our answer might just show somebody that being a faithful disciple of Jesus Christ is possible. Right. I think that's powerful. My one thing in our time with Sean McMasters is that idea of Jesus being my true north.
Oh yeah. I love that.
Loved it when he said that, and you'll feel it. Our listeners will feel as he talks about Jesus Christ and just how good he knows Jesus to be. You can't help but smile, and your heart feels a little warmth. It's kind of cool. What's your one thing?
Yeah. I mean, I think my one thing is that, to stop chasing my tail and just understand that I already possess it. Right. And, I love that idea. And, you know, when you get to that section of the podcast and you hear Sean talk about that, I think that'll resonate with our listeners as well.
Yeah. Hey, to Sienna, to Jonathan, to Abigail, your dad's kind of a rock star. And yeah. We really, really appreciate what he laid down for us tonight. We appreciate the way he showed up. We appreciate his story, warts and all, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't hold any punches back in letting people know what he's been through. Man, what a great place he's in now. What a rich place he's in now. To his friends, right? To his friends at the Vineyard Church, that congregation. We want to commend Sean McMasters for the way that he's walking the walk right now. So to all of our listeners, we hope you find your one thing in your time on this episode of The Richest Men in Town with Sean McMasters. Tyler Gould.
Yeah.
The gift of influence. Tommy Spaulding.
Oh, yeah. What's this guy all about?
I'm highly recommending this book, right? This might be one of those that I actually close when I finish and pick up and just start rereading it. It's a pretty powerful, concept, right? That we talked about influence before as parents. We've acknowledged that really parents of older children, that's all we got, right? That's all we got. It comes down to influence. But it starts with this gripping introduction. He's on a plane. The plane experiences some extreme, severe turbulence, and people hit their knees and kind of start praying. They think it's going to be the end. And he's actually in a mental space and in a just dealing with the burdens of life where he hopes the plane goes down.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And the plane doesn't go down. The plane, everything works out. And so he realizes exactly how bad the spot is that he's in. And he does work, right? He does work. And he shares that journey, and he shares the idea that, so George Bailey, I've actually reached out to him, invited him on the cast. Tommy Spaulding, I've invited him on the podcast. Pick up my invitation, Tommy Spaulding. We'd love to have you on, because it's so George Bailey, right? Like he jumps into this idea of influence. On average, he says that 80,000 people, Tyler Gould, are going to come in and out of your life in the course of your days.
Okay.
He talks about this idea of, like, with those 80,000 coming and going, what experience are they having with you? What influence do you have on other people? Right. And he gets into this kind of George Bailey idea, that footprint of what we mean to other people, the connections that we have with other people, and how important it is that we exert influence to help people along their way. So
how does he recommend we exert influence?
So he's got some cool stories, right? So the first part, he talks about lifting.
Okay.
He talks about lifting, and he talks about this eighth grade math teacher, right? The eighth grade math teacher, it's got a Friday before spring break, so it's a wasted day. And she's like, what am I going to do with these kids? And she says, okay, here's the thing. Take out a piece of paper. Here's the list of kids in the class. Write something nice about every one of the kids. And she collects the papers. And over the spring break, she would then take, like, Tyler Gould would get a piece of paper with all of the things people said that were nice about Tyler. Mike Freeman would get a piece of paper, right? Mike across the top, and all the things that my classmates said about me that were nice. So she does this thing, and she thinks it's just a thing, right? Spring break happens. Kids come back from spring break. She hands out the papers and it's on to math. Turns out the kids grow up. They graduate. They this is back in Vietnam. One gets sent to Vietnam and dies in the Vietnam War. And the family reaches out to this eighth grade math teacher and says, we'd like you to come to the services. And she's like, okay, I knew the guy, but I didn't, you know, like, I'm not sure. Okay. So she goes to the services. She goes to the lunch afterwards. And the dad says, come with me. And he brings the teacher into his son's room, his deceased son's room. Okay. And there's a war helmet, a soldier helmet on the bed. And he goes to the soldier helmet, and you know how they have bands, rubber bands kind of on the edges of the helmet. And tucked under one of the bands, he pulls this stained yellow piece of paper, taped up, right, and hands it to her. And she opens it, and it was that piece of paper from eighth grade.
Nice.
And so she starts welling up, about to cry, about to tear. Other classmates of the deceased student walk into the room, and they have their pieces of paper. Right, these are grown adults.
Right.
And that one little thing had an influence on them, right? And so we talk about this all the time. We do these little things that to lift other people, and we're not necessarily mindful that we're doing it. Turns out it has a significant impact on people. So lift was one. Embrace was another. This idea that we don't have to be the best people. We need to be engaged with people, helping them to be better.
Right. I like that.
The next step he recommends is acting. We got to do something, right? Einstein says nothing happens until something moves. And he tells the story of a guy who in his business section, gang violence breaks out, and he quits his job basically and engages with gangs and tries to find out what the problem is. And, you know, they get a business venture together to try to get people to be included and to have other solutions than violence. So he felt compelled. He had a sense of determination to do something, right? We talk about empathy, and empathy is this feeling, and then compassion is the feeling with intent to do something about it. So we got to act.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's not bad. And then the last one, his last point is devote. We got to commit. We got to sacrifice. We got to serve. And we've got to dedicate our life to being of influence to other people. So, and it just happens to spell lead. So that's cute. You know,
That's a very teacher thing.
Very teacher. Guys, thing.
Yeah. That's a very teacher thing. Well, yeah. Listen, we got a guy on our show tonight. Sean McMasters is going to join us. And I think Sean would probably has a few things to say about the power of influence. I think Sean's been an influence in some people's lives. So why don't we kick the doors open and let Sean in the room?
Let's do this.
Let's do it.
We're going to see what Sean McMaster has off the top of his head on the subject of.
Yeah, this is like gun.
Creating influence, right?
That's right. Running gun, man. Running gun. Sean, it has been just a few years since we've talked.
This is like a high school reunion, right?
It's like a high, yeah, 30 years later, man. Here we are. Enterprise 93.
Has it been 30 years?
They tried to have their 30-year reunion this summer here in town.
They tried and it just didn't.
It fizzled out. Nobody showed up.
Well, you know, what are you going to do? Here we are, man.
Honestly, well, I've been invited to my 30th the next weekend, and I'm on the fence.
Yeah. I didn't even go. I live here.
Yeah. There you go, man.
I was like, I'm good.
Well, Sean,
I was thinking maybe you'd convince me that reunions are a cool thing, but you're clearly not pro reunions.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I guess not. It's just not my thing. Yeah.
I'm with Sean on that. I'm a selective reunion guy, right? Yeah. Like, there's some people I want to reunite with. Correct. And I'll find them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I'm my time.
Well, I
started looking at all the pictures of people that were going. I'm like, if I ran into you at the supermarket, I wouldn't even know you. You know? And so I'm 100%. Like, I don't. Yeah. So that was my deal. I didn't go.
That's all right. I'm with you on that, man. So it's been a little bit since we talked, but I will say this about Sean. So I don't know, like however many years back we connected via social media, like people do. Right.
Yeah.
And you kind of just get this like outside picture, but you have a family, I want to hear about your family and kind of dig into that a little bit, but you've got some stuff going on and I'm excited to kind of hear what's been happening in your life, man.
Yeah.
It's
been exciting.
It's been, but before we dive into it, before you came on with us, we were talking about Mike's reading a book right now called The Gift of Influence by Tommy Spaulding. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the people that influence our lives and the influence we have on other lives. So give me your thoughts on the power of influence.
The power of influence, man. Well, I mean, it certainly is a gift for those of us who are in positions of influence. It's a pretty powerful thing, man, to be able to be in that position. I know as a younger man, I think I wanted to be in places of influence. And even though now I'm not in like places of huge influence, it is a huge responsibility to know that you as an individual, what you say can actually help people make decisions. And that's a huge responsibility. And just being able to be influenced by other people to remain teachable. I mean, I think that that's something, especially as we get older, you know, to always just try and keep a posture of knowing that you certainly don't know it all. I mean, I hope that as we age, we certainly realize that more and more, you know, but just having a posture of being able to be a student. I teach at a rehab. I do a class and oftentimes the guys are wanting to like jump in there and I think they want to teach, they want to have influence. But I do think in terms of just like the position of the teacher or the student, that the student has more power but it's just so good to be a student your whole life, like not to stop being a student, you know? So I think that that's also so, but right. Cause I'm influenced and I influence. So just trying to, you know, walk in that dynamic.
Yeah. I love that
Tommy.
Idea.
Yeah. Tommy Spaulding, makes this idea, like he quantifies it, right? He does some quick and dirty math and comes up with this idea that 80,000 people on average will come across Tyler and Sean and Mike, right?
Yeah, so that idea
of like when they do, what does that experience look like, right? This is The Richest Man in Town. It's Pat, like we love the story of George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life, and just this idea of like every life touches so many. Is it for good?
Is it for
bad, right? I like what you were sharing about we influence and we are influenced. Right. And just that idea of like, who are we with? Who's influencing us? And is that a good thing? Are we mindful of that?
Yeah.
I like that. I like that idea though, of that, Sean, you talk about being humble, right? I mean, I think that, I mean, there's people that I know and respect that I feel like they want to influence people.
Correct.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
You see it.
Yeah, and it's like, and I love that they've got some important things to say, but at the same time, it's like it's almost like closing off channels to being influenced.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I love that idea of kind of being humble enough to say, "Hey, I don't know everything," like you said, and I'm willing I'm willing to learn. I mean, that's sort of what the premise of this podcast is all about, right? Like three dudes getting together, having a conversation,
always a student.
Yeah, that's right. I love that.
Well, let me read this just as a parent and this idea of influencing. Let me read a little excerpt from Tommy's book here. He's driving his son to hockey practice. And I want to preface this by saying, you know, something that we've talked about, Tyler, on the podcast earlier is Clayton Christensen has a book called How Will You Measure Your Life?
Right.
And he says this is what he knows about kids. Kids aren't always ready to learn, but when they are, you better be there.
Mm.
Right. So, this is an early morning, crazy early morning. I guess his kid is like uber elite, teenage, hockey phenom, and he's driving him to practice. And the kid from the back seat says, "Dad, Daddy, what does it take to become a captain?" Simple question, right? Team captain. The author says, "In my half awake state, I replied, to be Captain Tate, you don't have to be the best player. You have to be the best person. The captain has the greatest heart on the team, but more important, has the greatest influence on their teammates. Being a captain means embracing your weakest teammates and helping them become the strongest." And then the story goes on. There's this kid. He's really struggling on the team. The team makes fun of him. Tate draws near to him, asks questions, befriends him, gets to know him, helps him become better. In the end, kind of a Disney ending, his son becomes the team captain.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But like, think about that. We get questions all the time from the backseat from our kids.
Yeah, sure.
And how many times are we really understanding the influence that our answers might have?
Yeah.
Something to think about next time kid asks a question.
Right.
Now, I'm sure the author doctored up that question, right? His answer was like, I'm sure it wasn't like as textbook as that great answer was.
Yeah.
But it worked with the kid. The kid took that to heart and went and became a better person. So.
Right. Which I mean, and then too, like, you never know what words are actually going to stick. Right. You never really know. Like, that moment, actually, it stuck with him. And so, I mean, I guess in terms of like influence, I guess, for him, who are the author, you know, trying to be consistent with my values, who I am, how I want to represent myself, being authentic, because I don't know, you know, you think people are listening all the time and they are. I guess they hear you all the time. I don't know when they're listening, if that makes sense, because, you know, like, your kids hear you, but they are not, sometimes they're just not listening. Right. But then sometimes you're like, oh, wow, you really heard that, for good or bad, to be honest.
Or bad.
Right. Yeah. Because I know my kids hear me and listen to me sometimes, and it's unfortunate that I influence them in that way.
Yeah. Dang it. You picked that up. Of all the things I said, you picked up that one thing.
Yeah. Remember when I was five and you're like, dude, let's hear it. Hopefully I remember.
Let's do a quick shout out, or they'll never forgive you. Right. Let's do a quick shout out. Give me kids. Give me ages.
Yeah.
Unless that's too pop quizish. Right.
Yeah.
Give me your kid's name.
Yeah. So I have three kids. I have Sienna is my oldest. She's 19. Jonathan is my middle, and he's 17. Yeah, almost seven. No, he's 16. All the birthdays just happened. And then Abigail's my youngest, and she's 15. And so Sienna is studying psychology at UC Davis. Jonathan wants to be an engineer, and I'm not totally sure what Abigail wants to be, but maybe a hippie that drives around a VW bus and helps people who are hurting.
That's not bad, huh? That's not bad at all, actually. Jeez, that's pretty good.
Well, ask other questions.
I want to do what Abigail wants.
Well, just ask other questions, you'll get different answers. You'll be like, okay, John.
Well, I love what you said, though, Sean, about, I think, like, because you're right. I mean, especially when we talk about our own kids and the influence we have on our kids, which is certainly there. It's certainly real.
Yeah.
But I think that, to your point, they're not always tuned in to what we're saying, you know, and I think that the word that you use, consistency, is the important part, right? Like, if we're consistent, and I know that we're going to screw up, you know, my kids probably could write a paper about all the dumb things I've said or done.
Yeah.
But I think if we're attempting to be consistent in representing our values, then I think that there's, you know, the fact that Abigail wants to drive a VW bus and help people is probably pretty consistent to looking at her mom and dad's values of how they look at people.
Sure. In certain ways. People, yeah.
Right?
So,
I love that, man. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, and I think you also, another word that you mentioned there, Sean, was this idea of authenticity.
Yes. Right?
Like, we've got to make sure that the space that we are showing up in is authentic. If we're trying to be of influence and help people and lift people to higher ground,
yes,
it's important that we're honest about our own walk, right? We're honest about our own mistakes. We're honest about those things. And I think that ties into that idea of always a student, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Always a student means I'm not fronting like I've got this thing figured out.
Correct.
Our kids are well aware that we don't have it all figured out.
This is true. Yes. Yeah. And being authentic in the sense too of like, you know, God created me and God created you because that's who he wanted. And he wanted you and me to represent, him, I guess, you know, to reflect his kingdom and his goodness through us as we would demonstrate that. But I know that in terms of like going back to the influence idea, like I'm influenced by other people and I want to be like other people. I see other people. I'm like, oh man, like I wish I could be like that or, you know, and some of it we take and it's good and it influences us in good ways, but then we can get caught up in a copycat world trying to be people that we aren't. And so, you know, just trying to be being authentically yourself is actually not that easy to accept yourself for who you are and to say like, dude, this is me and this is how I'm shaped and these are my limitations and these are the bad parts about me, the way that I see the world that's just kind of jacked up. And these are the good parts, you know, so that's.
And
not,
I think that picture you're painting is constantly changing.
It is.
Right. I mean, ideally, we're not saying this is me, deal with it. It's never going to change. It's like right now, this is me.
Totally. You're right. And even one of your questions was, what would your 20-year-old self say to you? Or did you like, right? And I'm like, it's so wild, the journey that I've been on and still, and you guys too, right? You're like, parts of you are the same and parts of you are like, whoa, you know, I talked to a friend in church. He's all, if I met my 20-year-old self, I would not like me. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think I'd like me either.
Yeah. Right. But I love that idea though, that like, you know, you mentioned authenticity and being able to kind of look at yourself honestly in the mirror and say, hey, this is where I feel like I'm succeeding.
Yeah.
And this is where I feel like I'm falling short.
Yeah.
And not let the falling short sort of define you, but there comes this point where you can say like, I'm falling short and I'm willing to do some work to make some changes to that.
Wholeheartedly.
Right? Yeah. And I mean, at 20, it's hard to look yourself in the mirror and say, yeah, dude, I'm really falling short here and this is what I'm going to fix. But I think as we get some mileage, we're like, you know what? There's some things that need to be adjusted here. And change.
Wholeheartedly. Yes. Yeah. At 20, at 20, you're out there trying to fix everything. You're like, no, let me show you what to do. I'm sorry. Sorry to everyone. Well,
I love this. I love this idea too. You know, Sean, you make reference to this wild journey.
Yeah.
Between who you were at 20 and who you are now. And here you are meeting up with Tyler.
Yeah.
And you guys are down this road. It's just kind of cool to have some time to learn more a little bit about what that wild journey is, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's been 30 years, dude. It's gone by in a blink, huh?
That's crazy. Yeah, time is an interesting thing, right?
The days are short and years are, or days are long and years are short.
Years are short. That's it, man. Like, that's
dang,
it.
Dude.
So, Sean, tell me a little bit about like, let's talk about that journey. Like, what does that look like? Can you, before we get into that, can you talk a little bit about growing up? Just tell us a little bit about family structure, siblings. What does that look like?
And
what does young Sean look like?
Yeah. So born in Los Angeles, I'm first born and my mom and dad, my dad is full Scottish. My mom's full Sicilian. My dad dies when I'm 5. And so I really only have about 4 memories of him, and probably coming to find out later on in life that probably one of the more poignant memories I have is not going to his funeral and how that affected me long term. Then my mom ended up hooking up with one of their party friends in their friend circle down in LA and took the and took the family and went to South Lake Tahoe. And so then I essentially in South Lake Tahoe from about five and a half, six, all the way up until 16. You know, Tahoe was really kind of wild. I mean, Tahoe is beautiful. I'm just so thankful to have the chance to grow up in the woods. I mean, no one lived on my block. We would stay out late playing in the snow. My mom and stepdad worked at a ski park, so I skied every single weekend, and they ran a snack shop in the summertime. So I was at the beach in the summer and skiing in the winter. But my stepdad was a very abusive man. He partied really hard. And so he was, I don't know if he was an alcoholic, but he drank a lot and he used a lot of coke, and, you know, they would have parties at the house and people would be getting high. And so there was no faith, in the house whatsoever. And so then I was the recipient of a lot of physical abuse from my stepdad, from all the way up until we left. I mean, I saw and experienced things, you know, now looking back, that were just pretty wild. I mean, I would get beat down pretty hard, pretty hard-headed kid, mouthy kid, always had this sense of what justice was. And so, you know, I knew that this, some of things were unjust. And so when you share that with a grown man that's abusive, then you're probably going to get a bit more of unjust that's going to come your way. So then eventually, you know, my stepdad, my mom had another kid, which is my youngest sister. So there's three of us. And so, you know, two at the same time, unfortunately, you know, my, you know, I have a younger brother that then I abused, and my younger sister, I obviously didn't treat well. So then my mom fled to Redding, California, because her older brother lives here, and he, was like, hey, move to Redding. So I came to Redding. And so, you know, South Lake Tahoe, because of the ski culture there, it was really like, progressive in terms of like style and music and all of these things. And then when I came to Redding, I literally thought I was moving back into like the 50s or something. I was like, where am I? This is so weird. Like everyone, no one really, like, they kind of dressed up, but they were like weird fashion. And it was just, on the one hand, it was weird. On the other hand, it was refreshing because I kept trying to keep up with all the fashionable people in Tahoe. And I skated, but I was never really a good skater. I was a pretty good skier, but it was all skating back in the day, right? You know, so it was all the, you know, the Powell Peralta board that you have behind you, like all that stuff. That's what we're into. And so then coming to Redding, not a lot of that was here. And so then went through high school.
It sounds like your story, Tyler.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's totally relatable, right?
Yeah. Coming to Redding, wherever you came from. I knew when you moved here that you weren't from Redding. Like, you know, I was just like, this dude is not from here because he's not like a cowboy or, you know, I mean, there was the cruise when I moved here, dude, you know, that we literally drive around like it was American Graffiti, the movie. Like it was just so, wild, so foreign to me. So then in high school, I don't do good at school because I just don't care. I didn't want to try, didn't like authority figures, just thought it was normal, you know, but of course, as I look back, I can see why I didn't like authority figures. And so then I think about 16, I just started drinking. I remember at one point in time in high school, just thinking like, man, I've been drunk every single weekend for as many months as I can remember. I'd just get drunk every weekend, right? And so I didn't think much about it. I graduated high school, and I graduated with a 1.8, I think, is what I graduated with. And I just didn't care. And I did just what I had to do to graduate. And I didn't think much about the future. And so then after high school, went to Shasta College, and then dropped out. I was going to try and be a law enforcement person for some reason. I think probably because of my ideals about justice, but then dropped out. But then it was during that summer. Do you remember Chris and George Summers? Do you remember that name?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah.
Yeah. If you might not picture them, but then remember the name. So I was living with them. I was living with this other dude, and he was on meth. And then me and this other dude were sharing this laundry room for $60 a month. And we were, you know, taking acid all the time and trying. My whole goal for the summertime was to get drunk and go to the lake and get laid. I mean, that was my goal, right? And so I was achieving my goals for the most part. And then my buddy he was a backslidden Christian, and he kept telling me to read the Bible, and I kept telling him to shut up, that it was a crutch. Somehow my great aunt's Bible, King James Version, like older, so old. I mean, you know, it's pretty close to like an original manuscript at that point in time, right? And so then I just pick it up and I read the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, and I read it, and I had never read something in my life. It's still palpable to this day that the words felt like so real. I had never experienced anything like that. And so then I watched football, American football, and you see the signs for John 3:16. And I said, well, what's John 3:16 say? And so I went to John 3 and I read through that. And it, you know, he's talking to Nicodemus and he says, you have to be born again. And in that moment in the laundry room by myself, you know, crazy party house, I'm like, you know, Jesus, I want to be born again. And it was real. I mean, it was straight legit, man. And so then the guys all come home and we're growing. So
this is just you in a laundry room in John 3:16.
Yeah, the Beatitudes and then John 3:16 because of football signs, you know, at the goalposts, the people hold their posts.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's John 3:16 say? So then, you know, we're growing weed. And so we're always looking for an excuse to smoke weed. And so everyone comes home and two of the guys are Catholic. And then two of the guys, even the guy on meth, he's a Christian, you know, in whatever way he's trying to follow Jesus. And then we have a backslidden Baptist dude with me. And so they all come home and I'm like, dude, we're all getting high tonight. Not that we weren't getting high every night. I'm like, hey, we're getting high tonight, dude, because I'm born again. I got born again today. And everyone's like, what happened to Sean? Like, Sean is tripping out of his mind, right? So then what does a Christian do? A Christian goes to church. So I have long hair. I'm driving a bus, VW bus. I'm in tie-dye. And I'm like, Christians go to church. So I go to North Valley Baptist Church here in town. And I have long hair and I'm wearing a tie-dye and shorts because I've always known, even before this, like God loved me. And God loved me unconditionally, not by how I looked at all, man. Like, no way. And so I roll up to North Valley Baptist, and everyone's in suits and ties and dresses. And the greeter guy says hi to me, and I sit down in the pew, and no one says hi to me. So that was my first church experience on my own. And so then I went home, and then I probably did that like 3 or 4 times. And I'm like, you know, so I'm wrestling through so much. I mean, I am born again, but then I'm going home and there's chicks and there's booze. And, you know, and I'm like, well, I don't know how to navigate this. So I probably went there like 3 or 4 times. And I'm just like, well, this is stupid. No one's going to say hi to me. So I'm just going to bounce out of here. So then that's what I did. And then I think a year later, I was washing dishes at Olive Garden and a dude told me to fight fire with the Forest Service because you could do it with long hair and make good money. And I met this dude named Jim Wills and he had a Vineyard Christian Fellowship shirt on. And I said, are you, and we were running laps because you had to get into shape. And I'm like, hey dude, are you a Christian? He says, yeah, I'm a Christian. And I said, are you sober? And he said, yeah, I'm sober. I've been sober for a year. And I'm like, there's no way anyone can be sober for a year. And so he invited me to the church. I walk into the church. It's about 15 people. And I went to that church every single Sunday. I would show up hungover. I never missed a Sunday, dude. I started tithing like almost right away, you know, because I'm like, heck yeah, dude, 10%, who cares? Like, this is awesome. Like, I didn't know how to navigate not having sex with my girlfriend or how many beers or joints I could smoke. But I'm like, all right, 10%, that's fine. And never missed a Sunday, man. And that's now the church that I pastor.
Wow.
Whoa.
Okay. So yeah, let me ask some questions about
that. I need to go back. Tyler, if I can go back, yeah. I love this idea. You talked to us a little bit about Tahoe experience and mm-hmm. and this idea that I've always known God loves me.
Yeah.
Can you put a finger on that, or is that like at a genetic level, or was that something your mom would whisper to you, or where does that come from?
You know, I don't know, man. I mean, I think that that's just one of those, you know, I don't know. I know I've always just known that, not that he's loved me unconditionally, but that he loves unconditionally, right? I didn't know that unconditional love, but I knew that he loved unconditionally. And so I remember one time when we first moved here, there was this church that was down the street from us, and I went to go play basketball on the church premises, and I had to hop a fence. And I think somebody, I don't know who it is, it's obviously someone that had authority at the church, came out and told me I had to leave. And I was probably about 14 or something at that time. And I literally just started yelling at him, telling him that he was like a hypocrite. Like, dude, I'm like, God loves me unconditionally, and you're kicking me off of this, you know, playground because I'm trying to play basketball, man. You know, like, are you being like, come on. So I had that theology in my head that God loved unconditionally before I knew he loved me unconditionally. And then just to be able to go to the Baptist church, and like, I wasn't going to dress up. I didn't go there because, I didn't change my clothes because I like wanted to be a rebel. I was like, no, God loves me unconditionally. And the irony is too, is that the part of the movement that I'm a part of now, it came, and I had no idea about any of this, but it came out of the Jesus movement down in Southern California, to where Calvary Chapel started, you know, allowing all the hippies to come in. And what's the movie that just came out? Jesus Revolution?
Jesus Revolution. I think so. Right. Yeah.
That's the story of the vineyard. And so I had no idea about this. And they were just like, no, like, we're seeking Jesus. I don't have to dress up a particular way to be loved or to have my faith be validated, to look a particular way. So I don't know where that came from, but that's never changed, even regardless of like some of the harder sins that I've had to wrestle with in my life, right? Because obviously, as you walk this thing out, I've had to wrestle with certainly harder sins than getting saved. And
I love your story, and I appreciate you letting us in on that journey. Tyler, so many things are resonating, kind of bouncing around in my head from conversations that we've had in our own personal experiences. But just this idea of like God meeting you where you are.
Totally.
Right. Yeah, like this 100%. before I had this podcast and I had some of the conversations that have come from this, I would think that, you know what, God talks to us. That's revelation. In order to have that revelation, you probably need to be sober. You probably need to. Right. And it's like, he's going to meet you on the road where you are.
Totally.
And he's going to take you as you are.
Wholeheartedly.
But he's not going to leave you there.
No.
Right. I think that's the key. He loves you. He's going to meet you where you are.
Yeah.
But he's got a journey in mind for you.
Wholeheartedly.
And there's going to be some things. There's going to be some changes. There's going to be some things that you're going to have to set aside, right?
Yes, yeah.
I think there's like this. I love that idea too of just like knowing that God loves you, you know, even though you haven't had, you know, the formal experiences with God, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I love that idea because I think that we recognize truth.
Yeah.
When we feel it, when we hear it.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I had an experience when I was a young man, and an adult at a church told me one time that because I listened to punk rock music, I was going to hell. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And I remember when he said it, I thought, well, that's wrong.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know anything, but I knew that's not how God works.
I can't put my finger on a verse. Right. I can't point, but I know that's wrong.
But I know that that's not how God works.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
You know what
right.
I mean? So I think there's these moments
funny
where we can.
I've been the 14-year-old hopping the fence, and I've been the church official kicking 14-year-olds off the church property.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I love the idea that he's throwing doctrine back at the guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Sean's like, no, God loves me. And
yeah, yeah. Right. Loves unconditionally.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So,
but still trying to work out that how does unconditional love apply to me? Right.
Yeah.
I think there's like that I think that's part of like faith journey in general, right? We understand that maybe from a, you know, from a 10,000 foot view, we can understand that, okay, God's in this, but is he involved in my life?
Yeah, right? Sure.
Like I can see how he's involved in things, but is he involved in my life? And I think that there's some work obviously that goes into that to make that happen. But I'm curious too. I just, you know, I appreciate you sharing that, what you shared, Sean. And you know, you talked a little bit about being a young boy and having that influence of a stepfather that wasn't always great. Right.
Yeah.
And then that sort of influencing how you dealt with things as well.
Yeah, sure.
So how does that counterbalance work, or when do you start looking at how do I counterbalance some of the behaviors I don't like and make those changes? I mean, that's a tough thing, right? Like even where we sit today with some mileage behind us.
Yeah.
And some things behind us, I think it's still difficult to look and say, all right, how do I dig into these things that maybe aren't the best part of me, and how do I make those changes?
When it was even clear that it was influencing you, right? You said that in that abusive situation, you were actually abusive to other people. Right?
Of course. Yeah.
So how do you undo that?
You know, well, I, as a young man, I didn't understand or know what had actually happened to me. I can't say that I thought it was normal, but it was my normal. I was unaware of how that had influenced me. And so then, you know, once I met Jesus, you know, one of the things that was interesting for me, you know, in terms of like the church and Jesus, one, Jesus is my true north, meaning that he actually gave me something to hold on to that I had never experienced before in my life. He gave me a true north to walk towards, and that in terms of meaning and values and in terms of being a man, that I had just never experienced before in my life. And then I think on top of that, which is still Jesus, right? Because Jesus is the head of the church, in that the church is actually Jesus's body in terms of theology. And so then to be able to experience men within the church, which I had my uncles, you know, but their influence was coming and going, you know, but in terms of like going to the church, I hadn't really engaged in families and really allowed men into my life. And so it wasn't until later on that I realized like I hated men. You know, like I, dude, authority, like, what are you going to do? Punch me in the face? Like, I don't care. You know, what are you going to do? Tell, you know, cuss at me and put me down? Like, dude, that's my normal, like, bring it. Like, it doesn't really matter, you know, but then to experience men who didn't do that, and to experience, you know, father figures in my life, that actually helped to heal that in my life. Then I think once I was given a different example of how to be a man, and how to live life, I was able to then, you know, take inventory of my own life and say like, man, I have not done this. And so I know that I, you know, apologized to a lot of people and had to take ownership of a lot of the things that I had done. And still to this day, I don't think that ever ends. And fortunately or unfortunately, you know, and so then I just, you know, there was a term, and this is funny that I bring it up, but it's just something that resonated with me in the feminist movement in the 60s, that they had this idea that if they can't see it, they can't be it, in the sense that if women don't see like female judges, then they'll never aspire to being that. But, you know, I'll flip it on its head and just say, if I can see it, I can be it, you know, or, you know, but if I don't see good dads, how am I replicating that in my life? And so then once I was exposed to that, I was like, oh, wow. You know, Jim Wills, we were fighting fire one time, and I was a, you know, young punk kid and just hard worker. And, you know, I loved what I did and I worked hard. And there was an older dude on the crew with us, and he just couldn't pull his weight. And so I got all after him and I was just cussing at him and yelling at him or whatever. And so Jim, you know, in front of the whole crew just lights me up, man, cussing at me, you know, all this stuff, which is all language that I understood. I'm like, I get, okay, cool. You know, whatever. I didn't think much about that and I didn't have much self-reflection about it. But then we got on the bus and Jim stood up in front of everyone and said, hey, I just want to apologize for the way that I had acted today. That I shouldn't have done that. And that's not how a man of God should represent himself. I don't think that I had really ever seen a man apologize. And so to be able to see that and say like, man, that's, I want to be more like that, you know, and certainly you have Jesus, you know, yeah. But you're trying to figure out how to follow Jesus too. Cause it's all, that's kind of like, how do I do this? You know,
he
seems to be able to do more than I can do. So that's, you know, then just trying to
lower lights, Sean, lower lights. It's something that I'm always talking about.
Yeah.
So Jesus is perfect. And I love him. And I love you said that he's my true north. I love that.
Yeah.
But are there some people that are striving to be like him in my life that I can look at?
Yeah.
Right. That I can look at, like, what is a husband who's angry or a dad who needs to say sorry? What does that look like? And I think that that's where Matthew 5 is real. John 3:16 is real.
Yeah.
So is my coworker, or so is my friend. Right.
Yeah.
And I love Jim for doing that. I don't know Jim, but I love Jim for doing that on the bus because he owned it and he showed you, look, I'm not perfect. And when I'm not perfect, this is what a man of God who's trying to be like Jesus does.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
It was powerful.
I'm curious, Sean, you know, if, you know, looking at the examples that you had in your life, right?
Yeah.
Previous to Jim, right?
Yeah.
And you meet this other group of men and you're going through what did the idea of having kids and starting a family look like? I mean, I mean, for any young man, there's trepidation, right?
Yeah, sure.
You're stressed out about it, you worry about it.
Yeah.
But I got to imagine, like, was that different for you? Was that
talk to me about
that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I don't you know, well, in high school, like, I had no idea. I mean, so as a young guy, it was just sex. Right. I mean, that was the thing. So I would watch movies or, you know, I don't think I was exposed to porn until I was probably like 17, 18, you know, but the goal was just to have sex. And so then generally most of the relationships I have were kind of predicated on that. You know, it's like we're going to have sex and we'll be a couple and whatever. But then all of a sudden, so I'm living with a gal when I get saved, man. And so I'm telling her, like, hey, I'm following. Well, not when I'm saved, a little bit after. And then we're living. So I guess I got saved. Then I went through a funky period of, like, you know, and it's not North Valley Baptist's fault. I go through this period of, you know, wandering. And then I hook up with this girl and it all starts to go again because I start going to the Vineyard. And so then we're in a relationship and I go to a Promise Keepers event, dude. And so the pastor at that time was kind of burning out or having a hard time. And so at the Promise Keepers event is the first time he ever finds out that I'm living with this girl. He's like, are you living with a girl? I'm like, yeah. He's like, are you guys having sex? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you need to stop. I'm like, oh, man. Okay. Yeah. That sounds totally cool. So I go home and I tell her, like, hey, we can't have sex anymore. She's like, what? And of course a guy who's like in his 20s, that doesn't last very long. I'm like, oh, well, whatever. And so then we break up and, I go and move up the street and I'm living literally on the deck of some friends that I fight fire with because I need to be celibate. I'm like, I have to stop. And so we're still partying. It's a lot of fits and starts in terms of my walk with Christ. And so then later on, I get into a car accident and I am getting to the marriage thing. I get into a car accident and we roll down this hill and I get out. And I walk up to the top of the hill and I put a dip in my mouth and I'm like, Lord, if I had to have faced you today, I would have been so ashamed of the way that I'm living my life just in relation to what the gift you've given me. And from that point on, man, I've just jammed. I started going to different church services all the time, man, fasting, reading my Bible every day. So then I started leading worship at the Vineyard.
Did that scare you?
I was ashamed. I realized the gift that I was being offered and what I was putting into it was literally like I was giving peanuts to someone who was handing me like diamonds and gold, man. I'm like, thanks, dude, for everything that you're doing for me, but whatever. I remember being at a Bible study and they're like, Sean, why don't you stop partying? I'm like, it just seems so lame to follow Christ all the time. It just seems so boring. It's like so dumb. I've always been an honest guy. And so I was straight up honest with them. They were cool. They're like, whatever. And so then that's when I started to encounter Christian girls. And that's when I started to encounter that there's such a thing as premarital Christian sex with Christian girls. And I was like, I don't want any of that. Like I had all that and none of that was helpful. It didn't fulfill anything in my soul. And so then eventually this girl walked into the Vineyard Church and I literally felt like it's one, you know, there's several times that like God's spoken to me and I felt like God said, you're going to marry that girl. She walked in a blue dress. And I felt like God told me I was going to marry her. I was like, I didn't even know what that meant. And so then we became friends. And then eventually I was hanging out with some of my nieces and nephews and cousins. And I just thought like, man, Linda's going to be such a good mom. So I called her up and said, hey, you know, I have feelings for you more than just friendship. Which totally like freaked her out and she had to go and pray. And then people had to give her like prophetic words and all these things. And then we decided I had never had a relationship that wasn't based on sex. And so then we decided, and she said she kissed some other dude once. I've yet to meet this guy. I just never met anyone who was so pure. And I knew that I had, you know, done everything that I've done, which a lot of it is really like sad and gross. And so we decided not to kiss. And so our first kiss was at the altar. We never kissed until on our wedding day. And I just wanted to honor her and honor her purity.
I love fits and starts. I love fits and starts, and I wish I could say fits and starts were behind me.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are still
those
things that are fits and starts, and I think it's important to. And maybe I'm off, but like this journey, I love how you fast forwarded, and now that's the church that I'm a pastor for, right? Like there was some stuff in there that you are where you are in your faith walk.
Yeah.
Not because of one experience in a laundry room.
No.
Right. No. That set the course where you come to meet Jesus of Nazareth. And now.
Wholeheartedly.
Now you're trying to. And I love too, this idea of like, I didn't know how to navigate.
Yeah.
Right. And there's, we need to be patient with people. We need to be patient with ourselves as we're all trying to navigate. What does this path look like as a disciple of Jesus Christ?
Totally.
But it's not about like I had one experience back in 1993 and everything's different. I mean, you can have the one experience and everything is different.
Yeah, sure.
The faith that you exercise with your congregation today is something that you have built every day.
Yeah, sure. Right? Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, I think it's interesting though, if you think about, you know, we talk about influence and Sean, you talk about the influence of your stepfather and kind of that time of your life. But then you talk about the influence of Jim Wills and some of these other men in particular that modeled sort of the opposite behavior. Yeah. And, you know, I just love that idea of that people come into our lives and they have the ability to steer us, right. To help us see like, all right, look, you know, where you're going, it's not the worst thing, but let me show you a better thing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
But we started talking about influence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Imagine if Jim isn't wearing that t-shirt.
Yeah, that sure. Day. Yeah, yeah.
Jim's not living it, right? I mean, that's the thing. Like,
yeah. Well, and the funny thing is too, like when we think about influence as well, like all of us, you know, following Christ, we think oftentimes, and it's a wrong belief in my mind, that we have to be a picture perfect representative of both myself and Christ to be able to influence people. But I don't think that's the right idea, man. Like, God uses us where we're at to be able to reach the people that are around us. So, dude, Jim was still cussing and chewing, and but that was attractive to me where I was at. It was one step ahead of me, like this idea in right. the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, right? You know, so like just one step ahead of you, you know. And so, and the other thing that was really attractive to Jim was just he was himself. He was authentic. He was both following Jesus and attempting to follow Jesus, knowing that he's not Jesus, you yeah. know. And so not to excuse us of anything that we don't want in our life, you know, but he was just himself. He was authentic. And that made me trust him. And that made me believe that I could do it. You know,
well, the one step ahead. Yeah. The one step ahead on the path is that he was able to answer that question. Are you sober?
Totally.
And that was the step you needed, right? Like, whoa, that's possible.
Whereas I think a lot of people in maybe some religious circles would have said, well, how long are you sober? I've been sober for a year. And they would have said, well, gosh, that's lame.
Right.
Just 1 year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So weird. But, you know, I guess it, you know, God,
from where you're sitting, you're like, that's incredible.
I thought it was impossible.
Right.
No, literally, I thought he was lying. I'm like, dude's lying. This dude's lying. I can't imagine being sober for a year.
Mm. Wow.
No way.
And that goes to that point, right? It's not the task that changes. It's our nature and our strength to do the task that changes.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Right? To where you were, that idea of being sober for a year is a Mount Everest.
Yeah.
Right. And then you start realizing, oh, maybe a small win here, a small win there. And you start to think, oh, what once was impossible now. And I think of Luke 1:37, right? With God, nothing's impossible.
Right. Yeah.
And I
think
that there's something powerful there. You know, early on, Tyler, I got to say, Jim Wills is my vote for MVP in Sean's story, man. He's definitely.
I feel like we need to have Jim Wills on the podcast, man.
Oh, my gosh, dude. He's
definitely
a wild,
right place, right time.
He's a wild dude, man. He's still is a wild dude. Yeah. He's super funny.
I love that though.
So
I love
Linda, that you receive that personal revelation and Linda's the girl.
Yeah.
You don't even kiss her.
No.
Right. And yeah. I love what you said. I just wanted to honor her.
Yeah.
Tyler, I've had a couple of times where I walk away from weddings and they'll use the word cherish. And I go back to my wife and I say almost without fail after a wedding, you know what? I need to do a better job of cherishing you. I need to do a better job of honoring you. Like, you know, cause I mean, we're 25 years down that road. Right.
Yeah.
It's important to remember some of these verbs are like crucial when it comes to keeping that relationship. Tyler, I texted you earlier today, just this idea. I was at church and a guy hands out a 3x5 card. And the 3x5 card has three letters on it. WMM, what matters most.
Mm.
And it's got 1 through 5 written on the 3x5 card. And his invitation is, gentlemen, I want you to reflect and think about what matters most in your life right now.
Mm.
Write it down and carry the card.
Mm.
Right? It's been fascinating putting that card in my pocket every day.
Because
one is my covenant relationship with God. Two is Kelly Rose Freeman.
Mm.
Right. And you start looking at like, okay, what are you doing on a daily basis so that your actions mirror or line up with that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yeah, right? Sure.
Because 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, none of them have anything to do with earning a buck.
Yeah.
None of them have anything to do with what I'm doing, you know, 50, 60 hours a week.
Yeah, sure.
So there's a wrestle there, right? There's a little bit of a wrestle. How do we live in this life where time is finite, and how do we dedicate that time to those things that actually do matter most?
Yes, sir.
Interesting wrestle.
So I'm curious, Sean, you know, if you look at your role as let's just your role as a father.
Yeah.
What are you hoping that your children are learning from you?
Well, they're all teenagers right now, so I wish we were having this podcast like 10 years from now, dude. Yeah. We're in the thick of it, man. My wife came home. She's all, my friend calls them meanagers. I'm all, I think we're adopting that term.
100%.
Meanagers, man. Like, whoa. Well, and I know it's a phase. I mean, I think that, you know, I hope that my children would, you know, well, certainly, what does a man of God look like? What does it look like to follow Jesus honestly? And by honest, being honest, I mean, you know, I'm well aware of all the shortcomings that I have, and so is God, and so is my family. But just being able to be okay with the fact that I both strive to measure up and I do not measure up, and that's okay. And that God's mercy and what Jesus did for me is more than sufficient. And that, you know, in 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made him who had no sin to be sin, and that we might be called the righteousness of God. That, like, we are literally the righteousness of God because of what Jesus did for us. And so, not by what I do, not that what I do doesn't matter, and not by what I say, and not that the words that I say don't matter, but that it's, you know, by grace. And so, and that's very uncomfortable. You know, there's a book that I've never read, but I've said the title a million times, by Abraham Herschel. He was is a Jewish rabbi. I don't know if he's still alive. And the title of the book is called The Insecurity of Freedom. And that freedom and autonomy is very scary, and it's very hard. And you know, you get presented with situations that you don't know how to handle, and you have to wrestle with your own fear, and you have to wrestle with your own hurt and pain. And so then being able to live that honestly in front of your children is both wonderful and just horrifying. So I think and hope for them that they would be able to just see me being an authentic follower of Christ. And then two, what does it mean to be a man? For my daughters to be able to see, like, what is a good man? And for my son to be able to say, like, what is a good man? And what does that look like? And you know, for them to be able to not try to follow in my footsteps, to do what it is that they feel called to do. You know, being a pastor of a church, you know, I'm not, I don't try to be heavy-handed in telling them that they have to be Christian or they have to follow Jesus, although it's my deepest desire. And so I've allowed them to have space to be able to, you know, experience what they have to experience. And that's just what they have to do. I've always been really open with them, like, hey, can I have a boyfriend? Of course you can have a boyfriend. It's your choice. I'm not going to tell you no, because you have to experience that. But these are the, you know, pitfalls that you might experience when you have a boyfriend. Or can I smoke weed? Well, of course you can. You can do anything it is that you want to do. You have choice, you know, but these are the pitfalls that might come from that. But I will be here for you if you choose to do any of these things, you know. And so, yeah, I think just being authentic, helping them to navigate their own life and faith, and empowering them to be able to be their own people. It's super scary.
Well, that book title is ringing loud and clear in my ears right now, right?
Yeah.
Security of freedom. As you're having these conversations with teenagers and they're at these, you know, crossroads in their lives, it's like, welcome to agency, right? Totally. Welcome to the ability to act and not be acted upon. But if we do take some actions, we will be acted upon, right? There are just bottom line, there are some things that are designed to rob your agency. There's addictive nature to a lot of sinful things that are presented to kids. I mean, kids, adults too.
So. Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I love too this idea, this concept of grace. Earlier when you talked about peanuts for diamonds.
Yeah.
In the end, grace for us, I mean, my understanding of grace is it's always going to be some kind of peanut.
Totally. Right?
Like our best,
Yeah, totally.
Right.
It's all, yeah, no. I want them to be good peanuts, dude. You know, I want them to be the best peanuts I can, you know, yes.
We give our best, and that's the strive, right? We give our best.
Yeah, right, but knowing that it doesn't change, right? Like I always say at the church, there's nothing you can do or I can do to make God love me more or less. He just loves us where we're at, not who we ought to be, not who we should be, not who we might be. He just loves you right here, right now. That's great.
John, I think that's deprogramming some myths out there, right?
Yeah.
That messaging is so powerful because I think this idea of like, I got to qualify or I got to earn it. I can't come to him dirty. I got to clean up before I can come to him. No.
Yeah.
Right. Like I'll be honest. I was having a conversation today, super intense conversation about some broken lives.
Yeah.
Right. And some broken lives. It was a secular place. I'm at work and we're trying to help people. And I literally in my notebook, in my spirit journal, Tyler, in the bottom of the page, I just write down, I feel like Jesus is in the corner saying, you know, I can help this.
Mm.
And I can't use my faith in Jesus in the corner necessarily in this secular place. And so I'm bringing broken tools of government programs.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, can we have a real conversation about what's needed to fix these broken lives?
Mm.
And that's so it's frustrating. Yeah.
I love what you said, Sean, though, this idea of you said, I strive to measure up and I don't measure up all at the same time.
And hold them both.
I love that idea. I think it's so powerful, like to be able to accept that, right?
Yeah.
Because I think there's a level of self-destruction that can be in that statement, right? You're like, well, I want to be here, but I'm not getting there.
So
what's the point in the effort to get there, right?
Yeah, sure.
You know, we have that conversation of grace and that fills that gap and that gets us where we can see progress. But I love that idea of holding both things to kind of quote Brian Groh, a former guest, but you know, that we can strive to measure up and we can fail to measure up at the same time. And
that's what's happening all the time. You're like, man, you know, that is what it means to be human. And
So Sean, in your role as pastor and working with folks, how do you help people shut up the voice saying you never will? So why try?
Well, I mean, you know, good theology. I'm a huge fan of good theology in the sense like, you know, theology being what we believe about God. If I believe God to be an angry individual who is always trying to do the gotcha with me, then I'll live my life in fear and hiding from him or trying to hide from him. You know, but if my theology is that God loves me unconditionally, he doesn't love the things I do unconditionally, right? Because sin is certainly something that he does not love. But he loves me unconditionally. And that I am, every person is created in the image of God. And so that knowing that every person is created in the image of God and that he loves us unconditionally, hopefully people are able to lay down the striving of trying to impress a father who is already impressed. One, in that he created us. Two, in that his son died for us and that we no longer have. Well, one, we could have never impressed him anyways, right? Because Jesus is able to do what Adam and Eve could not do, which is remain sinless. And Jesus was able to do what Israel was not able to do, which was to be able to keep the whole law. Jesus is so magnificent in every way. I still never grow tired of like thinking about who Jesus is, that he is in a sense, a reborn creation as it should have been without the stain of sin. And then he's able to do what no one else could do to demonstrate God's love for us. So hopefully, you know, the idea too, you know, that he doesn't love me as I should be, and he doesn't love you as you should be or ought to be or would be. You know, this idea that we measure ourselves, you know, by the things that we're not able to do. and the things that we do. But so oftentimes the loudest voice in the room is what we should have done or ought to have done or could have done, you know, any of these things. And so hopefully to help people stop striving to be, it's like a dog chasing its own tail, right? You already possess your tail, but
hamster wheel.
Right. So you're chasing it nonstop. But if you would just stop for a moment and realize that you already possess your tail, you already are what God wants because of what Christ did for you, to be able to rest in that. Right. You know, and so that the striving
Does that make sense?
Like, you don't have to strive because you already are. One, because you're, you know, like some, I forget what it is. He knit you together in your mother's, maybe 1:139. He knit you together in your mother's womb because he wanted you. And then just what Jesus did for us, you know, you're like, you don't need to be anything other than what you are.
And right? I think the miraculous consequence of accepting that is that then when we come to terms with who we are and we have find peace in that, then we automatically begin to strive to draw closer, right?
So if you can
accept that where you are, then the desire to become closer becomes stronger.
Well, and what I would say that unfortunately religion ends up becoming a cheap substitute or a false replica or an exoskeleton of what we should look like on the outside, but then the motivation to do so is from the outside in, whereas the kingdom of God is something that exists within you, right? The kingdom of God is like yeast that was put into the dough. So it's inside, it permeates the whole thing. And so the entire batch of dough is changed, not from the outside per se, but it's inside working. The molecular structure of it is changed because this living organism is now inside of it. And so then from the inside, I don't spend time with Jesus because I ought to or I should, but because I want to, because I want to be with him. I'm not ashamed to be with him. And so again, you know, religion, if you look at religion, it's a false paradigm exoskeleton that tries to manipulate people to look good on the outside, which then ultimately is just horrible. It's sad.
Right. We're kind of talking about this. Go ahead, Mike.
I think of John 15:5, right? Like abide.
Yeah.
Abide.
Yeah.
Totally.
Abide with me. And I think that, man, it would do us all good to study that out in our minds. What does it mean to abide in him? And we're promised as we abide in him, he abides in us like that yeast. And I think that when I hear you, Sean, and I hear you profess and share your love for Jesus and loving to think about how good he is, all the more powerful when we think about how low he descended,
dude,
right? Like crazy. that condescension,
yeah,
like that lowering below all. There's no one that walks into your building,
yeah,
long hair, hippie band in the parking lot. There's no one that can sink below where he has gone, and you can confidently look at anyone that walks in,
yeah,
and say, There's somebody that knows the road you've been on. And there's somebody. And there's only one that can make it right.
One, I think the whole idea too with abiding, like what you had brought up, for someone who looks at themselves and is ashamed or is striving, then the whole thing is just like, then stop. Not just stop in the sense of like, stop what you're doing, because I think that message is probably loud and clear already from a religious sense, but just stop and rest in him. Like rest, abide. Like, no, he does the heavy lifting, man. Just rest in him. Like, he's sufficient. And that's already a hard enough concept to grasp as it is. Whereas like, just as people, we love conditionally. I love you because you love me back. I love you more when you do things for me. I love myself when I do good, and I am ashamed of myself when I don't. So this idea of grace is really odd, and it's not really something that I think that we naturally come to. Like, even when Paul says, like, you know, it's foolishness to the Greeks and it's an abomination to the Jews. I forget totally what he says, even though I read it this morning. It's odd. It really is a weird thing to be able to think that God loves me unconditionally. Not that he loves the things that I do unconditionally, but he loves me unconditionally, which then I just need to rest in him. There's a scripture, and I was talking to somebody about this the other day, when Paul gets knocked off the horse, when Saul gets knocked off the horse, right? He has a totally Jewish paradigm, and Jesus is Jewish. But then he doesn't think Jesus is the Messiah, and then Jesus knocks him off his horse to have this paradigm shift. But at one point in time in Paul's life, he literally, and I forget where it is, and I should probably look it up, but Paul literally, there's this portion in scripture where he's just absent for years. Like, nothing happens, because he has to wrestle with this whole idea of, like, grace and Jesus and this huge paradigm shift, you know, this whole fits and starts idea, because it is awkward, because we are self-judging, merit-based beings. And so grace is super refreshing and weird.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, talk about weird. I just want to go down this irony road here.
Yeah.
You grow up having a thing against authority.
Yeah, sure.
And now on a Sunday at the Vineyard Church,
yeah,
you are speaking as one with authority.
Yeah, sure.
How's that? You ever pinch yourself and be like, oh, wow, that's been an interesting road. And the interesting thing too is you talk about this, I've always had this love for justice.
Yeah, sure.
And here you are now
in the preaching of mercy,
the gospel of mercy.
Yeah, sure.
Talk to me a little bit about how it feels to come full circle like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one is, and I want to bring this up because I think, you know, I know Tyler, in terms of, like, punk rock, there was a documentary out there. There still is one out there, dude, that's called The Other F Word.
I've seen it. Absolutely. Bro,
so funny, right? Where all these punk rockers, they're like, you know, rage against all authority, and then they're fathers, and they're like, don't do that. Listen to me, because I'm the dad. That's why. which my daughter just the other day quoted to me, right? Because when you have to get to the part in the conversation, because I'm the dad, she's all, right, oh my gosh, I hate that. I'm all, you'll say the same thing. No, I won't. I will never say that. I'm all, right. Yeah. No, I think that at this point in time, you know, in terms of being an authority figure, you know, I'm bivocational too. And so then I'm a therapist and I work primarily with men who have substance abuse disorders. I am honored. I am just nothing but flat out honored that I get to be an authority figure, in the sense of being able to be a living representation of the awkwardness and beauty of following Jesus. I don't take it for granted that I get to do this. It is sometimes extremely painful, and I just want to, like, bail and go, like, surf somewhere. But I am just honored to be able to represent Christ in the way that I get to. And so that's, I haven't really had to wrestle with that, you know, but that I would just hope to be able to be that person for someone, you know, and I get to be, I get to see that. I don't have to guess whether or not I am. I'm very thankful for that.
Well, I love that.
Go ahead.
I love that verb. And I think the air feels different when the word honor gets used.
Yeah.
And, you know, we usually ask our guests, how do you honor your parents? How do you honor the, you know, the people like Jim in your life and Linda? But I feel like you get to do that a lot these days.
I'm very thankful for that. Yeah, church being the body of Christ cosmically, literally, right? Which is weird because it's filled with people who are like, that you're like, this is a weird part of the body of Christ. We get to hang out with people like that. I owe a debt to this church that I could never repay. You know, I can look at my life and say that I wouldn't be here without this funny little funky church. And so then I just hope that it gets to be that for other people. And I'm thankful that it is, you know.
Man, I love the idea. You know, you talk about, Mike, you asked the question about being in a position of authority, you know, and if you look back on your experiences and authority figures sort of meeting out justice.
Yeah.
Right. And now you're in this position of authority meeting out mercy. Yeah. I love that idea of sort of the change or the transformation of what a person in authority looks like. Right.
Yeah.
And that's very cool. Very cool.
I appreciate the emphasis on good theology.
Yeah.
Right. The power of sound doctrine and Dude. The power of capital T truth when we are in a world of relativism and right all of the shifting values and the shifting of things. I think it's like we're on a ship going down and everyone's just looking for something to hang on to, and everything that people are grabbing outside of the gospel of Jesus Christ is coming off in their hands.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, we know these are challenging days, but as we exercise faith, they're optimistic days.
Sure, right? Of course.
They're days where our faith should replace fear, right? Perfect love casteth out fear.
Yeah.
You know, and those things are, sometimes we read those scriptures and they feel very accessible, and sometimes they feel like, ooh, that's a stretch.
Yeah,
that's
totally.
That's a tough thing.
Yeah.
Do you have any fears? What are you afraid of?
What am I afraid of? Well, I would say, I mean, back in the day, I was afraid of failure until I had like my major fail. What am I afraid of? You know, I still probably wrestle with, you know, this whole idea of like give the peanuts that I'm going to give him. You know, that still to this day am so thankful for who he is and what he's done. Not that I don't fear not being faithful, you know, but I just fear not doing as much as I could have, you know. I forget what the story was where like someone was on the seashore. It's like this, you know, goofy metaphor, and I hope that's no one's favorite and I just called it goofy. but there's like a million starfish on the shore. And, you know, the tide's going out and somebody says, we can't save them all, but let's save them all one at a time. You know, we can save as many as we can. You know, I mean, I think for me, I just want to be able, and I know that I will, that he will say, you know, well done, good and faithful servant. You know, but there's still that fear. And by fear, I'm describing something to where it's probably a lack of faith, right? You know, that I'm not doing enough, and that even this whole idea that, you know, me wrestling with maybe who I could be or ought to be, that's probably something that I've wrestled with, even though I mean, on the one hand, I'm like, no. But then on the other hand, you know, I still wrestle fear that, not that he'll be angry, because he won't be angry. But I just want to honor him as best I can, man.
I think there's something healthy there, right? I think when he's with his disciples and he says, one of you will betray me. I love that. Is it I?
Yeah.
Approach.
Yeah.
Right. Like I love you. I hope I am not doing anything. Is it me?
Yeah.
Versus like, oh, well, you know, it's that guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think that it's a healthy approach. It's a healthy approach to be able to say, Am I doing enough? And I think, you know, I think recently I've been thinking about these experiences that we can have. Any of us can have these experiences where God loves his children. And if we are wondering our state and our standing before him, if we approach him in prayer and say, how do you feel about me?
Yeah.
I bet you you're going to have an experience that's memorable, and it's not going to be a list of things you're not doing.
Correct. Right. I know that I do that to myself. I mean, and I think too, just looking, you know, at all the people that I wish knew him, I don't think that that desire in me has ever gone away. But as I'm getting older, I realize my limitations that, I mean, I would, you know, even Paul says that he would give up knowing Christ so that his Jewish brothers and sisters would know, you know, this desire to actually have people know Christ, you know, that's never gone away from me. I mean, it's drives me every day. And so, but it's overwhelming to see the amount of people who don't know him, you know, which is just a bummer. So that's kind of just what I fear. I guess I don't fear failure as much anymore because it won't kill you. Yeah. So that's probably
so 20 years from now.
Answer. Yeah.
Right. 20 years from now, you run into somebody. It's kind of like, so I'm in education, and every once in a while I'll run into a former student, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So 20 years from now, you run into somebody that was that was coming to your church. What do you hope they remember about your testimony and your messaging?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Your congregation.
Well, would hope they'd remember one of my sermons, but they won't, even though I put a lot of work into them. I remember point four of that sermon. It changed my life as I was taking a nap as you were talking.
Yeah.
I think I would want people, which is what they, and I, you know, I get pretty real time feedback. I'm really thankful for that. You know, that I felt loved, I felt accepted, and I met Christ, and that my life was changed, you know, by meeting him, that when we took communion, you know, that I met Christ, that when we worshiped together, that I felt something that I had never felt before. And that just that experience of experiencing him changed my life. That's what I would hope that they would say.
I love it, Sean.
That message definitely can, right? I think of so many things that are temporary about this life.
Yeah, sure.
The experiences that I've had with meeting Jesus Christ, as you say,
yeah,
those spiritual experiences, those change people.
Wholeheartedly. I don't change anyone.
Right.
I'm just a handoff, man.
Yeah. Have you ever had a time where you've poured hours into a sermon and you get up there and the Spirit's saying, take this thing in a different direction?
I haven't. Well, not recently. No.
I probably just jinxed you.
No, maybe. I don't know. I mean, sometimes in a service, yeah. I mean, we are a charismatic church, like gifts of the Spirit and all that stuff. And so sometimes I guess I resonate, you know, Martin Luther, there was one time that he decided, like, I'm just going to go up there and God's going to inspire me and he's going to speak to me. And I've only heard this, I've never read it. So it might be just like a folktale at this point. And that he went up there and he shared a message and it was like really bad. And they asked him, well, what did you hear God say to you? Martin Luther, never come up here unprepared again.
Oh man, I love that. I love that.
Actually, I was reading in my scriptures the other day, and I made a note in a margin.
Yeah.
In a reference to taking the Lord's name in vain.
Yeah.
I made a reference. I just made a little jot in the margin. That's teaching unprepared.
Mm.
You're right. Because I think we think of the blasphemy, or we think of like it's like,
yeah, yeah, sure.
Actually, no, just like walking in and being, I got this, or I'm going to win this, or I'm going to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We do. That is not his way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've certainly done some, not ad-libbing or whatever, but I generally, for the most part, I tried to pre- do my due diligence to make sure that the theology is sound and that I'm, I mean, the scary part in terms of like preaching and sharing the word of God is making sure that I'm not leading people astray or sharing weird, bad theology. I mean, that's always, I mean, that's scary. You're like, oh man, like, or misrepresenting that scripture. You're like, dang, dude, you said, or I believe this because you said, and so then that responsibility, that's pretty heavy, man. You know, I try and stay in my lane.
Yeah. Trunk of the tree.
Stay in your lane, man. Don't
get in those branches.
Main and plain, right? And that's the thing, too. I mean, don't try and get off all weird onto some like. Yeah.
So paint a picture for me, Sean, as you think about your life. Can you tell Tyler and I about a moment where maybe you take a mental snapshot of what's going on around you, maybe who you're with or the things that you're doing, where you have a moment and you think to yourself, this is a rich moment.
Mm.
This is rich.
You know, if I was to say a rich moment, it will always, I can't say a specific time, but I know a specific place. And it will always include the kitchen and the dinner table and with my family. From a young child growing up, my mom's full Italian, right? My dad died, so I never knew his family. He was an only child and they passed away. And so it was always Italian dinners. My grandma and grandpa would always cook these huge crab feasts at Christmas time, and I'd be the last one eating and everyone would be making fun of me. And so that experience of being there, even though the funny part or the irony part is that now as I've gotten older, I realize just how awkward those moments might have been for the adults who were at the table because there's unresolved conflict or there's, you know, all those things. But just being able to share that moment, even though everything's not picture perfect, whether or not it's like Thanksgiving or, you know, just sitting down for a quick meal. You know, being able to go camping like this last summer and cooking up ribeyes over the fire with my family, you know, being able to, you know, eating and drinking and just being with one another. There's something so communal about eating with one another. And even Jesus talks about the whole, you know, the wedding feast, that he's not going to drink wine until the wedding feast. So food and, you know, and him eating in the Last Supper, or him, you know, put the net on the other side and cooking fish after he's resurrected. And,
yeah, eat with me,
even,
right?
Dude,
yeah.
even if we were, if you get crazy, there's the book by Alexander Schmemann called For the Life of the World. And he's an Orthodox theologian, and it was an underground manifesto when communism happened. And so he wrote this, and he just breaks down this idea of even communion. Like if you think about food and the rich life, so, you know, communion in terms of like, if I understand it rightly in Corinthians, communion took place at a meal. So they were all eating together and Paul, you know, admonishes them for getting drunk and some people eating too much, you know, but communion being fruit and bread, everyday items, it's not gold and diamonds because the rich don't possess that, but it's just everyday man in everyday household that the kingdom of God is supposed to be there. And so eating together has always been and still is this thing, you know, when I dream about having grandchildren, I dream about eating and cooking for them, that food is love and to be able to spend time with them, to have that communal. It's one of the, eating together is one of the few sensual, intimate things that we get to do with other people. That's not, it's not sexual, but it's intimate and sensual, right? And so we get to do that, and it's weird and it's vulnerable because there's noises and smells and like things happen that are somewhat embarrassing, you know? And so there's just something binding that happens between us communally when we eat together. There was a proverb, I forget, it was like anonymous, and how long does it take until you can call someone a good friend? And the proverb said it takes a 10 pound bag of salt to become friends. right? Like you need to salt the food, yeah, like 10 pounds amount, like that. It's basically a marker of time and intimacy together. And so, yeah, eating together. I look forward to the day of cooking huge crab dinners for my grandchildren, you know.
Man, I love that idea. I love that idea. Sean, what gives you hope these days?
What gives me hope? I'm aware, you know, it's like, whoa, there's a lot going on right now, right, you know, but at the same time, you know, take dude backing up. And I think about this, man, if someone was born in 1900 and died in 1985, they would have gone through World War I, the Depression, World War II, the assassination of JFK. You know, it's so there's always been chaos.
There's always a lot going on.
Always a lot going on. We think that our times are always harder, but it's only because we're going through them. If you went through World War I, II, the Depression and World War II, you're like, the Lord is surely about to come back. You're like, no, it's real, which in part might have been why the Jesus movement happened, right? Because, you know, they're like, Lord, no, the Lord's coming back. You need to get saved. What brings me hope these days? I think that Jesus, yes. But I think that what brings me hope is rational, educated dialogue that people who are mature enough to still be able to come to the table and have mature, rational, educated dialogue around topics that are very, very difficult in terms of like racism, sexuality, religion, politics, that people, I was thinking about it even today, that we're the only creature on earth that has rationality, that we can actually be rational. No other creature can do this, right? No other creature has a prefrontal cortex.
Those dolphins are pretty smart, I heard. But
they're pretty smart. Yeah, they're pretty smart. But the idea to be able to have like, to actually be able to have the maturity to sit down and have rational dialogue, that gives me hope amidst all of the fads that are happening right now and the polarizing topics, and that, you know, people have made it this far, I assume we'll make it further. I'm not a humanist. But that, and that, you know, the church prevails too. I mean, that always fascinates me, for as many mess ups as the church has had, that it just makes it and that the message still gets out. That trips me out, man. Broken as we are, it's this, some people just keep finding Jesus through us. That amazes me to no end. I'm like, wow.
He's only had imperfect people to work with, right?
Totally. And it keeps happening. Yeah. It's just so amazing to me that just continues to get out there, man. So that gives me hope. Those things give me hope.
I think of that. I think of his disciples on the ship, right? He's like, Master, care us not that we perish. And
yeah, yeah.
Jesus knows he's not dying in that boat.
Totally.
Right.
Right.
And it's like we freak out and we panic because we maybe lose sight of our end destination, or we lose sight of like what we will become.
Totally.
And
well, even taking a step backwards, let's not forget that homeboy was napping.
He was napping. Right. He was napping.
Let's take a step back. Dude was napping. Okay.
Yeah.
So in the midst of all of this, we're like, wake up. And he's like, dude, just take a nap.
Relax.
Lay down. Let me just like sing you a lullaby and put you to sleep. And
you know what? Your answer about what gives you hope gave me hope. So I appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I appreciate that answer. Right. And I think too, so many times because we hear something different, I think that natural man response is to kind of like, I'm going to just go turtle. I'm going to throw up some judgment. I'm going to throw in some assumptions start building some walls and not ask and not have the conversation, where actually if you leaned in
totally
and had the conversation, like that's what I love about this podcast format. This is a conversation.
Yeah. Right.
I believe conversations can actually change the world.
Oh,
we can. And I actually, to marry your last question too, there is something powerful about crab or lasagna or totally. French bread, right? Like we break bread together, things happen, right?
Totally.
We can sit down at a table of brotherhood and just have conversations over some lasagna and some salad and some French bread.
Totally. You know,
maybe, just maybe, we can build community.
Wholeheartedly.
Sounds too simple, but I think the best answer is a simple answer, especially I mean, especially when we're talking faith, matters of faith, keep the moving parts simple.
Right?
Like,
totally.
I don't need to get like that idea of staying in my lane.
Yes.
I need to make sure my compass is pointed true north.
Totally.
That's it. End of story. So,
yeah, I agree.
John, it's almost been a couple hours, man. And I got to tell you, it's crazy. It's been a blast just, talking and catching up and learning.
You can basically check the reunion box off, man.
Yeah, we just
there you go, man. Me and Todd, dude. 93, go Hornets.
It's all done.
Yeah.
But you know, this podcast, Mike talked a little bit about George Bailey and that the film It's a Wonderful Life. And you know, the title of this podcast is taken from that film. And we love that portrayal of George Bailey and the irony of his life being in shambles, yet being such an influence on others and allowing others to influence him.
Yeah.
You know, we end every podcast with the same question and we'll offer that question to you as well. But Sean, what does it mean to you to be considered the richest man in town?
To be the richest man in town for me would, I guess to summarize it, would be to know that I am loved and that it is a God-given gift that he has given me to be able to love others.
I love that answer.
That's what makes me the richest man in town.
So
can't give what you don't have, right?
Yeah.
Once we know we have love, give it away.
But we're 140 some odd episodes of this podcast.
Yeah.
And we ask the same question every time, 140 some odd times.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's never been a repeated answer. And
really?
Yeah. And I love that. I love your answer. And I would agree with you. As you say it, there's so many things you said tonight that resonate with me. And I appreciate you sharing your journey and your faith and man, I've loved it. It's been awesome to see your face and to learn from you tonight.
Yeah. Well, it's been good to hang out with you guys, man. This is my first podcast.
All right. One of many, man. One of many.
Hey, buy yourself a mic and start your own, man.
Yeah.
No joke. That's what we tell our people.
You guys got mics, man. I see that. I need
one. You sound fantastic. I'm going to walk away with all kinds of homework, Tyler, but seriously, this is what I'm looking at. I got the other F word to go watch.
Oh, dude, yeah, that's so a great
one. The other F word,
so great, funny,
so funny, dude. Yeah.
Well, hey, we want to thank you and shout out to Linda. Shout out to your kids for letting us borrow some of your time. I know time is precious these days. You know, you talk about a kitchen and a dining room full of people. Enjoy that, because I'll tell you, in a blink of an eye, you think 30 years went fast.
Yeah.
Right. In the next couple, you're going to have a blink of an eye. It's going to be like, whoa, Linda, where did everybody go?
Yeah.
But they'll be cooking for grandchildren, man. And that's what I'm talking about. Right.
I'm stoked about that. I really am, man.
Dude, you and me both. Yeah,
I really am.
Especially if you got grandma's recipes, right?
I got a whole book, man. She made one.
Did she?
She did. It was a present to all of her kids. Yeah.
No way. That's great.
That's what I'm talking about. That's rich. That's rich right there.
It is.
Sean, it's been an absolute blast, man. We appreciate you. Have a great night. And we'll do it again soon sometime.
Yeah. All right, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
All right. God bless you guys.
Good idea, Ernie. A toast. To my my big brother George, the richest man in town.